The Milwaukee Brewers had an interesting road trip. They won 5, lost 4. Yes, yes, they lost all 4 games against the Chicago Cubs. They scored 2 runs in the series, but they're still winning more games than they're losing. And as we wake up on Thursday morning, they're back in first place in the National League Central, tightly contested NL Central. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast. I'm going to be joined today by Tom Haudricourt, the beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talked a lot about the pitching staff, which has been amazing. The bullpen, the starters. We had an outing from Wade Miley on Wednesday, his first of the year. Junior Guerra has been excellent. And Josh Hader a few nights ago with a historic performance in which he struck out 8 batters in a 9-batter stretch. All of his outs for a 2 2/3 inning save were via strikeout. He is the National League Reliever of the Month. So we talk about that and more. After that, I have an interview with Taylor Williams, Brewers reliever. He's an interesting story. He missed 2 years in a row with recovering from Tommy John surgery. His surgery, he got hurt kind of at the outset of the year in 2015. Didn't have surgery until later in the year in 2015, in August. Didn't come back for the 2016 season. Made it back for 2017. Got called up at the end of the year. And wound up getting his Major League debut, and then he's been with the team quite a bit this year here in 2018. So I chatted with him last time the Brewers were in town. Hope you enjoy that. I am joined now by Tom Haudricourt, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, we've had an interesting road trip for the Brewers. They, of course, everyone knows they lost the 4 games in Chicago, but they won the 2 in KC before that, wrap it up with 3 games against Cincinnati. And the narrative that is around this team is that they do great against last place teams. They've happened to play a bunch of them in the early part of the season, and not so great against great teams, namely the Chicago Cubs. This is a narrative that drives me crazy, because in baseball, I just don't feel like there's such a thin line between great and bad, and I feel like wins are wins. I mean, when you hear that, and I'm sure a lot of people have asked you that in interviews and stuff like that, how do you respond when people ask, I mean, is this just a good team against bad teams?
Well, I'm going to address that in my Sunday column for the Journal Sentinel, my weekly Brewers column, because it's going to have to change in May. If you look at their schedule now that they finished that series against the Reds, their schedule for the rest of the month is pretty daunting in terms of current one-loss record. They play home and away series with Arizona, which has the best record in the league, 21-9, as we speak today. And they play Colorado. They play the Mets again. They play the Cardinals again. The Twins are the only team on their remaining May schedule that have a losing record. And I would have to say they're probably a disappointment in that regard, because a lot of teams, a lot of people thought they would be back in the playoff hunt again this year. And there's certainly plenty of time for them to do so, but they've scuffled so far. So that if that is a true narrative, and not just a coincidence, it's going to have to change in May, or they're going to have a rough month.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, against the Reds, Wade Miley made his Brewers debut. He had a nice outing. I thought his curveball looked great. He wasn't crazy about the control. That's been, the command has been something that has haunted him in recent years and kind of knocked him off the path of a pretty solid big league pitcher. And through spring training and everything, it seems like he has sort of fixed some of the things that have ailed him. Where would you sort of rank the confidence level the Brewers have in his arrival? Do you see this as a stopgap until Jimmy Nelson returns, maybe just an upgrade over what they had with Brett Suter? Or is this more than an experiment, that this is a guy who could legitimately be a contributor in the rotation the rest of the way?
Yeah, I think that Wade Miley will give him that answer. And if he pitches great between now and when Jimmy Nelson returns, whenever that might be, then it might change their overall plan. The one thing that I've learned about rotations, JR, in all the years I've covered baseball, is they're subject to change. Who thought when the Brewers broke camp that Junior Guerra would be their most consistent starting pitcher so far? He's been great since they called him back up. So that's why you want to have as much depth as possible in the rotation, because you're going to start with 5, but you're probably going to use at least 10. Even the most successful teams probably use at least 10. Only the very rare team gets through with 5 or 6 for a whole season. Usually if you do that, you win your division. I remember in 2011 when the Brewers won their division, I think they only used 6 starters all year. I think Marco Estrada was kind of the wild card when Narvison got hurt. So Wade Miley will answer that for him. They love the way he pitched in spring training, but then of all things, a groin strain, fielding a bunt on the final week of the season. He had the ultimate buzzard's luck because the next day they had to declare themselves on putting him on the roster or allowing him to be a free agent, and he got hurt. So they struck a deal, kind of a gentleman's agreement, that he would get healthy, then go on a rehab assignment in the minors. Then when it was deemed he was ready to join the team, they would have to make a decision on him or let him go and to go look for employment elsewhere. So you knew they weren't going to go that far with him, JR, all through spring training, then on the DL, then a rehab assignment, and not at least take a look at him. You just knew they were going to do that, and they have.
So let's go back to talk about Junior Guerra. It's so easy to forget that 2 years ago he was the ace of the staff, and he was phenomenal. He's had such an unusual career arc, and I don't know. Is there one thing you can sort of pinpoint that could explain what it is that's allowed him to take this jump and be such a huge contributor?
Well, he got hurt on opening day last year. He pulled a calf muscle breaking out of the box on a bunt, and he just never recovered. He missed a lot of time. When he came back, he wasn't the same guy. He lost his command, and he just sort of lost his place in line, if you will. So it's only to his credit that he showed up in camp. He pitched pretty well in camp, could have made the rotation there. He's probably the sixth guy, and then when they needed a starting pitcher, they brought him up, and he's been great. And his splitter is the key. That's his pitch. Not a whole lot of guys throw it as much as he does. But it all starts with every single pitcher, JR, with fastball command. That's the foundation for every pitcher. And he's just had better fastball command this year.
Speaking of fastball command, Josh Hader. I mean, the starting pitching's been great. The bullpen's been great. Josh Hader is a marvel right now. We've talked a lot about him already. I don't know if there's more to say, but after you saw him strike out eight dudes in nine batters for a remarkable save a few nights ago, I mean, what more is there to say? What in the world are you thinking when you're watching Josh Hader on the hill?
Yeah, he's the rock star of a band that's putting out a bunch of hits right now.
Yes, he is.
The Brewers bullpen has been on, and this is minus Corey Knebel. We cannot understate how good the Brewers bullpen has been without their closer, Corey Knebel. He's been out with a hamstring injury. He's on minor league rehab now, so we might see him back in a week or so. Bullpens, as we have discussed, are built from the back forward. And so a lot of times when you lose your closer, it just implodes the bullpen. Guys have to change roles, and it becomes kind of a mess sometimes. Well, it's been exactly the opposite with the Brewers. The first couple of times they had one-run leads after Knebel got hurt, I think they slipped away. One of them was, I think, some terrible infield defense played a big role. But since then, it's been fantastic, and it's been different guys. The Brewers bullpen is so unusual since Knebel got hurt in so many ways. The primarily the fact that many different guys are closing games now. I think they've had four or five different guys save games since Knebel got hurt. So that's different. The other thing is the number of multi-inning saves they've had. They've had a bunch of multi-inning saves. And well, Knebel, excuse me, Josh Hader's eight strikeout game, that was 2 2/3. And Jeremy Jeffress has had several multiple inning saves. I think a lot of times that was not the plan going into the appearance, but the reliever has had such a quick first inning that Council sends him back out there, and usually with fantastic results. So the bullpen's the reason they have a winning record. It seems like every game they win is a one-run game or a two-run game. They just don't beat you 10-2, And so their bullpen has been huge. And it's just so far the story of the team, because again, I'll say it again. Without your closer, it could have been a real mess. Instead, it's been a strength. I think right now their bullpen ERA is either second or third in the major leagues, not just the National League, but the major leagues in ERA. So they've just been fantastic, and it's the reason why they have a winning record.
Josh Hader was named National League Reliever of the Month, and I love the way Craig Counsell has used these guys. You're talking those multi-inning saves, multi-inning appearances even, not just the saves, have been huge, I think.
Right.
And then there's sort of an unpredictability with it that might even be an asset, I don't know, but also just the willingness of all these guys to be able to do different things, match up differently. Jacob Barnes has been used in big leverage situations before, Dan Jennings in big spots, and it's paying off across the board. It's great.
Yeah, they've suppressed their egos, and they're just as willing to pitch in the fifth or sixth inning as the ninth. And, you know, the final guy gets all the glory. It's only in some box scores that the H gets put next to guy's name, the hold, because it's not an official stat.
Right.
You know, and you get these holds if you come in with a lead and hold the lead. A lot of people don't realize you can get a blown save in the sixth inning. You know, you come in with a one-run, two-run lead and blow it, then that's a blown save right there. It doesn't have to be the ninth inning. And they just don't do it very often. I'm going to start calling Jeremy Jeffress Houdini, because it's like Craig Counsell says, what is the most ridiculous position I can put him in where it's impossible to hold a team scoreless, and let's see if he does it. And he does.
Yeah, I think he's only allowed two inherited runners to score, and if I'm not mistaken, one of those was on the Eric Sogard error in Chicago that was the deciding run. So it's you're absolutely right. He's coming bases loaded, nobody out, gotten out of that situation. Corners and one out against the Reds a couple nights ago.
Striking out Joey Votto, which happens about as often as Halley's Comet comes around.
You know, yes. Yeah, Hader struck him out, and Jeffress. Been a nice weekend against Votto for the Brewers. So a lot about the pitching, which has been tremendous. The offense, on the other hand, hasn't clicked to the degree that I think we figured it would. And we haven't talked on the podcast since the Eric Thames injury a week ago. On the surface, first base is a position where the Brewers are covered because Jesus Aguilar was swinging a very hot bat. Ryan Braun can play over there and actually has looked pretty decent over there too. I figure, though, that is the type of injury that shows itself the later you get into the season, because the platoon advantage that Craig Counsell has used, playing Eric Thames a lot against right-handed pitchers and likewise Jesus Aguilar against left-handed pitchers, I feel like over time that's going to bear out. That might hurt Aguilar's numbers. I think it'll hurt the offense overall. What was your take when Thames went down? Did you see that as a pretty devastating blow, or did it felt like this is one that the Brewers can absorb?
Yeah, not devastating because of what you just mentioned. They have really good coverage at first base, and if they want to go one deeper, they can always reach down to AAA and bring back G-Man Choi, and he would give them a left-handed bat as well, like Thames. But it's just the way they're going to miss two things with Thames. One is power. He was leading the team in home runs. You know, he was personally responsible for two-to-nothing victories over Cincinnati. He hit two-run home runs in both games. And so just the quick strike capability you have with guys like him. And the other is the righty-lefty balance. You know, one of the things that made their offense so much better last year was adding Shaw and Thames, two left-handed power hitters, to balance off all their righties. And then this year they added Kane and Yelich. Kane a righty and Yelich a lefty, and created even more balance. So you stop teams from matching up against you if you go lefty-righty, alternate your hitters in your lineup. You stop them from bringing in, like, if you have like three straight righties in your lineup, then and the other team winning by one run, they might bring in a dominant right-handed pitcher and cover all three hitters. And so just the balance and missing Thames. And so, but it should not be, I do not expect it to be devastating, just because, you know, this gives Aguilar, so far, JR, I've yet to see where giving Aguilar more at bats is a bad thing.
Let's move into some quick hitters as we wrap this up. Travis Shaw left the game on Wednesday night with a contusion on his foot, which is alarming, but it sounds like he'll be mostly okay. He sent out a tweet a few days ago channeling Aaron Rodgers with C-H-I-L-L, a throwback to Aaron Rodgers' famous relax sentiment that team was going to be okay, and hey, so far they are. They've come back and won the next three games. Makes me wonder, Brewers fans, I think, are thought of as maybe a panicky bunch, that when things start to go wrong, there's been a lot of negativity in the last, you know, the history of the franchise, really, so it's understandable why that might be a default position. Do you think Brewers fans are more panicky than an average fan base, or do we just only see the Brewers fans because that's what we know, and everybody's fan base to a degree does what this,
yeah,
you know, what this
I
is.
Think I think there's a panic button, you know, in every fan base. But I do, and we talk about this in the press box, because of the Packers' popularity and how good they've been for so many years, and how teams dissect everything they do 10 ways to Tuesday. Sometimes you do get a little bit of a football mentality where one or two losses might be devastating in a football season, or certainly change the whole arc of the season. In baseball, you play 162 games. You play 10 times as many games as the 16 in football. And so there are ebbs and flows in the season. I mean, look at this last road trip. I call this the broom closet trip. Nothing but sweeps, you know. They sweep the Royals. Then they get swept by the Cubs. Then they sweep, you know, Cincinnati. And you'll say, well, they beat the bad teams and lost to the good team, and there is some truth to that. But look at the Cubs' scores. They lost 1-0, 3-2, 3-0, 2-0. So is a sweep dominant as far as wins and losses? Of course it is. But the plus-minus in the series, the Cubs only scored 9 runs, and unfortunately the Brewers only scored 2. They do have to figure that out. They've been shut out 5 times by the Cubs already. It's you know, baseball is very fascinating. Yu Darvish, you know, who the Cubs spent $125 million on, and a lot of Brewers fans thought they should have got him. He's made 6 starts this season, 2 against the Brewers and 4 against other clubs. He has a 0.75 ERA against the Brewers and a 9.50 ERA against all other clubs. So you explain that one to me, you know. Why did he show up with his good stuff twice against the Brewers and in none of his other starts? And it's why baseball's the most fascinating game, because there's so much variance in it, and so much, you know, it just, there's almost a different narrative every day. Thank God, since my job is to create narratives, is to write narratives, my job and Todd Rosiak's job, thank God there is. But they're just, the narratives change so much. And how different would the narratives be if they would have scored a couple more runs in Chicago and split that series? It would have been greatly different, you know. It's what makes baseball so fascinating, is you don't know what's going to happen the next day. We're pretty sure in basketball LeBron's going to score 40. And we're pretty sure in football that Aaron Rodgers is going to throw for 350 yards when he's healthy. But who knows what's going to happen in baseball from day to day? I mean, right. There's no way to know. Pete Rose is the only guy dumb enough to bet on baseball. And look where it got him.
Yeah, you never know. Scooter Jeanette could hit 4 home runs in a game. There are so many examples of things you never thought you'd see coming that end up happening.
So we've already seen it. Yeah, you know, we've seen Hader set a record with 8 strikeouts. We've seen the first game in Major League history where the first 2 guys homered and the last 2 guys homered. You know, you just see something different every day, and it's the beauty of the sport. It's what makes it so uplifting, and then also so frustrating. Sometimes all at the same time.
Definitely. Eric Sogard has struggled this year. He did have that error I mentioned earlier, but at the plate, he's been particularly he's struggled a lot. I'm curious what you think about whether, I mean, because the veteran presence thing, I don't know if the team is going to be willing to eschew that for a minor leaguer to come up who may not, you know, might not be all that much better, probably better, but not that much better. So right. I'm curious what you think. Do you think his days are numbered with the Brewers?
No, not necessarily, because, you know, he's not playing that much. And so it's harder to get going, you know, when you don't have regular bats. Now, the double jeopardy there is maybe he might be playing more if he was, you know, swinging the bat better when he did play. So, but they're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna cut bait with him after 1 month, you know. Right. And you know, he does have a role, a veteran role on the team, and he's 1-3-4. Away from having everything solved. Three nights ago, Orlando Arcia looked lost. Then he gets five hits and six at bats over the next two nights, and now suddenly he doesn't look so lost.
Right. That's back to the previous discussion, how you just can't predict how this is going to play out on a day-to-day basis. So my understanding is you've got a little update to a book that you wrote a while back, or this is a brand new one. I'm not even sure. Give me a rundown of what you've got going on.
Yeah, I think 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote a book for Triumph Books called 100 Things All Brewers Fans Should Know or Do Before They Die. There's been a lot of kidding about the dying part, like I'm trying to wish people into their grave or something. But it's a book of short bursts. People love lists. It's very close to the list, except it's short chapters, not just a list. And so it did pretty well, I'm told, by the publisher. And so they decided the time was right to do an updated and revised edition. It had been a few years. The team had gone through a rebuild and now, has some heightened interest, if you will. And so we did a repackaged, revised and updated 100 things. We put in some new chapters, changed some of the rankings, updated some of the older chapters. Hank the Dog's now in it.
Oh, yes.
He wasn't around. He wasn't around when I did the book 5 years ago or 4 years ago. And the publisher only had one request of new chapters, and it was Hank the Dog. So that was non-negotiable. And so Hank the Dog's in there. And
neither one of your dogs are named Hank, are there? I heard one of them briefly in the background. You don't have any dog named Hank, do you?
No, we like alliteration. Our first two dachshunds were Brundy and Basil. They passed away in recent years, so now we have Digger and Dexter, excellent, otherwise known as the Double D's. And no Hank, but Hank does live in my neighborhood now. He moved. His family moved and moved him with him, so I have seen him in the neighborhood. So I feel. I tell my dogs all the time, you're among dog royalty in our neighborhood because
it's true.
Hank's a neighbor now. So appreciate you bringing up the book. You can get it on Amazon, I'm sure, in bookstores as well. Anybody who buys one and brings one out to the ballpark, just seek me out in the press box. I'll be happy to sign it for you if you would like. And hopefully people enjoy it. I had a lot of fun writing the first one. It was neat to kind of update it. And just shows the interest that Brewers fans have in the club, that the first time around did well.
Tom Augercourt, you can find his stuff at jsonline.com. He is the Milwaukee Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thanks much. We will chat with you again very soon.
Okay, JR, thanks.
Thanks to Tom Augercourt for joining me. Now we'll move on to talk to Taylor Williams, Brewers reliever. He's a Washington State native who has bounced around in college, but has worked his way up quickly in the Brewers organization. He had, even despite the fact that he missed two full years in 2015 and 2016 with needing Tommy John surgery late in the 2015 season. So he is a fascinating story that he's able to make it back to the big leagues. He's been one of those contributing members to that great bullpen and has been having a nice season. So here's a chat with Taylor Williams.
My guest is Taylor Williams, relief pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers. Taylor has an interesting story. He missed a couple years with Tommy John surgery, came back to the big leagues, and here he is now in 2018. We'll start, though, where you grew up. You grew up in the state of Washington, and when you went through college, you ended up at Kent State. Can you kind of go through the process there? Because that's not where you started. How did you end up as a Golden Flash?
So out of high school, I committed and signed with Washington State University, and that's where I attended my freshman year. Kind of towards the end of that season, I didn't feel like it was necessarily a great fit for me. I still kind of had the desire to play position, play the field a little bit.
Okay.
And at the time, we had players that they had kind of locked in for the positions that I wanted to play. So I went to Keene, New Hampshire that summer and played summer ball. And I ended up playing with 4 Kent State guys there.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so they probably brought you over.
Yeah, so they, well, a little bit. They were. I became really good friends with the second baseman there that played at Kent State, Derek Codevine. He was later drafted by the Yankees, same year I was. But basically, throughout the summer, I decided that I wanted to transfer. So kind of didn't want to sit out a year, so I decided to go to a junior college for a year, which was Mount Hood Community College, which is close to home, about a half hour away. And then during that fall, the guys that I had played with during that summer kind of talked to the coaches at Kent State, let them know that they had played with me and that I was looking to transfer. And so I went on a visit there, and they ended up offering me a scholarship, and the rest is history.
So you went coast to coast and then landed somewhere in the middle, so that's not bad. Your path didn't cross with Travis Shaw at Kent State at all, correct?
No, but my first offseason of pro ball, I went back to Kent State to train a little bit in the offseason, and he was in at the field house there at Kent State, so I met him during that time. And he played with a lot of the guys that I played with there, kind of overlapping.
Yeah.
And so I knew him a little bit, but not very well. But
okay. Yeah. You had a great season with the Timber Rattlers in Wisconsin in 2014, and then got promoted at some point. I don't know if the pain started popping up that season or if it was in the offseason. What was sort of the timetable of that when you started to have arm trouble?
I didn't really have arm trouble until that following spring training. I was fortunate enough to get invited to big league camp that year as an on-roster invite. Threw pretty well in camp. Only got in two game action in the Cactus League. And then when I got sent back down to the minor league that year to build my pitch count back up, it was my first start back on the minor league side. And that was kind of when I kind of really felt it during an outing. And unfortunately, the rehab process didn't really work out.
Right, yeah.
But I can't really say unfortunately. It was unfortunately fortunate that, you know, sure. Ended up having surgery and I'm where I'm at today.
Yeah, so. Right. It worked out in the end. So you had a platelet plasma injection. I don't know a lot about the science behind that. How were they explaining? Because they'd had success with that with another pitcher, Tyler Thornburg.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that's sort of a first step for a lot of guys who have arm trouble. So what did they explain how that was supposed to work, and then when did they realize it wasn't going to work?
Kind of like you said, I don't know the exact science behind it. I know they inject your blood and they go through a process where they spin it, and I think it kind of oxygenates the blood and then they re-inject it back into the area of the injury. It's supposed to help speed up the healing process a little bit, I believe. So unfortunately that didn't work, but like I said, fortunately I am where I am. So
I think it was August maybe that you did a surgery. At that point, I presume there was never a thought that you would be able to get back for 2016, or was that the initial goal?
Coming back from surgery?
Yeah, to be able to pitch within, you know, that next season at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it was a goal. Obviously, I knew that kind of the general timetable that they set for Tommy, coming back from Tommy Young surgery, is right around a year. So I knew that I'd be pushing it coming back for the end of that 16 season. I was lucky enough, I rehab with Nathan Kirby, who's also in our organization. So we were kind of going through the same thing at the same time. And they kind of took us a little bit slower route just to be precautious with this, which still allowed me to come back for instructs of that 16, which gave me about a month to pitch. And I was throwing live BPs before that as well down in Arizona.
You hear a lot that keeping the mind occupied is the hardest part of that rehab process. It's obviously a strenuous physical thing too, but what did you do? How were you? I mean, 2 years off is a long time, and I'm sure it was frustrating. What did you do to stay active, stay involved?
A lot of time spent in the sunshine in Arizona. We tried to get out as much as we could away from the field and in rehab. A lot of days laying by the pool, a lot of swimming.
That sounds great.
it wasn't horrible. Obviously, like you said, it's never fun to be injured and miss time playing this game that you love, especially when you're working towards your dream and your goal of playing in the major leagues. It's kind of a halt in that process. But you know, we played some video games during that time to occupy time. I did a lot of reading during that time to kind of maintain my focus and just try to learn some new things about different areas of life and different aspects. So.
I'm trying to remember when The Armor by Jeff Passan came out about that rehab process. That probably was a little bit after.
Yeah, well, it was kind of towards the end of that process, and I thought about reading it, but I was like, you know, I don't want to read all these horror stories and different things about it. I'm just going to... I'm going to let my path take place and, put in the work I need to put in and see what happens.
How often did anybody try to talk you out of coming back? You know, how often were you up against some doubt that this was not going to happen?
Not really. I think when I when I found out that I was getting the surgery, it was almost kind of a relief. It was kind of like, all right, I know what's going to happen. I know it's in my future. And at that point, it was really just a decision. It was like, you know, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to come back, I'm going to fully commit to that. And that's going to be how it is. And I think that if I had any doubts in myself, or anybody has any doubts in themselves throughout that process, then you're kind of selling yourself short a little bit. So it was something I fully committed to and tried to do everything in my capability to come back from, and fortunate enough I'm sitting here.
Yeah. So take me through the 2017 debut. You know, it's a big deal for anybody, and then for you, it's, you know, after 2 years of not being able to pitch and getting back into the game that year, I imagine it was like a lot of guys' debuts, but there had to be some pretty phenomenal satisfaction that came with that.
Yeah, I think the first step was just getting out of spring training healthy. Yeah. I think that's kind of everyone's goal when they go into spring training, just get through spring training healthy, get the work in that they need to get in to prepare for the season, and then go into the season and, you know, compete and try to get better and make it here. So, yeah, there were definitely lots of ups and downs, and it was exciting to get back out there and just pitch in game action, pitch in front of fans again. You're not in the Instructs game where there's not really anyone there. You get the adrenaline going again. You're kind of relearning pitching over again a little bit after missing two seasons, so a lot of it's mental as much as it is physical. So it was a trying kind of season, but I learned a lot about myself and about the game, and, you know, sitting here.
Sure. So with that in mind, anything change about you as a pitcher? Obviously the velocity obviously came back, but, you know, anything in terms of style, in terms of approach, anything different about you than you were 2 years before?
I'd say a little bit. I'd say I've definitely have a little bit different perspective on the game and preparation and how you approach the game to get ready every single day and to maintain my health. But from a standpoint of getting out there and competing, I'd like to think that I'm pretty close to the same guy that I was before. You know, I think you learn that the importance of your foundation as a pitcher and who you are and sticking to that. That's the consistency of your delivery and being able to execute pitches on a consistent level. And I think those are some of the things that you learn at the lower levels in the minor leagues is of what it takes to pitch at this level. You have to be consistent. You have to have a consistent delivery and be able to repeat that to execute pitches. So that's something that was big for me last season, going through the struggles.
I read that you were a pretty big Ichiro Suzuki fan, which makes sense, in the Pacific Northwest, and then you got to face him in your first home appearance, I believe. So what was that experience like? You did get him out, so not bad.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I didn't really realize what had kind of happened until the next day when I was walking out to the bullpen and he was in left field. And I was like, wow, I faced Ichiro Suzuki yesterday. He was one of my favorite players growing up. I was fortunate enough to grow up during that time where Seattle Mariners had a lot of good teams and a lot of good players that came through there. So
I went to one team, for example.
Watched a lot of games in the King Dome and Safeco Field growing up. So like you said, he was one of my childhood heroes, kind of being a big baseball fan. So it was exciting to look back and be able to say that I was able to, you know, play during it while he was still playing.
Yeah, no doubt, right? Yeah. It's kind of like playing with Jordan, I guess, if you're, you know, you grew up in Washington. But so, since he's one of your best, you know, favorite players and you wanted to play a position in college, I'm guessing you're a pretty decent hitter. Relievers are having a really good year. They're like 3-for-3 at this point. I'm guessing you wouldn't mind getting an at-bat at some point this season.
Hey, if it happens, I'm not going to complain. But I can't really...
So many circumstances.
I haven't hit enough in the last few years to really say I'm a great hitter still, but I'll have confidence when I go up there. I can tell you that much. You know, I'll feel comfortable in the box.
Taylor Williams, right-hander for the Milwaukee Brewers. Thank you much, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of the Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. We're going to catch you again, hopefully in the middle of the next road trip. The Brewers, after staying at home to face the Pirates and Indians, two-game set against the Indians, May 8th and May 9th this week. They are going to head out west. Colorado and Arizona are on the docket. Then they come back to the Midwest after an off day. Three-game set in Minnesota against the Twins. So the Brewers won't be back home until May 21st after these five games at Miller Park. So it'll be a challenging test for Milwaukee. Right now, the first-place team in the National League Central. We will chat with you again soon. Thanks for listening.